Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we look at the United States' relentless push for war, the costs and consequences of these policies over the years, up through the present, and where we're heading in the future. We are joined today by author and scholar Dan Kovalik. He is author of four books recently, including his most recent book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we welcome Dan Kovalik. He is the author of critically acclaimed The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, The Plot to Attack Iran, and The Plot to Control the World. Most recently, he is author of The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. These are all with Skyhorse Hot Books, which was David Talbot's series. The new book on Venezuela has a foreword by Oliver Stone. Dan Kovalik has been a labor and human rights lawyer since graduating from Columbia Law School in 1993. He's represented plaintiffs in ATS cases arising out of egregious human rights abuses in Colombia, has written extensively for the Huffington Post and Counterpunch, and has lectured throughout the world, including in our home base in Northern California. And Dan Kovalik, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show.
Fantastic. And of course, we'll make sure we announce that later in the program, but you will be in Berkeley August 14th. We'll make sure we give people those details. So Dan Kovalik, your work is always timely. Four books in the last 2 years. It's an amazing feat to accomplish. We do one a year at Censored, and you're always writing about something that's cutting edge, and a lot of the things that you're writing, extraordinarily timely. You recently co-authored an op-ed over at the Boston Globe with Oliver Stone, and it was for July 1, We Must Stop Our Nation's Push for Relentless War. Obviously, there's a thread and a theme there through all of your last books, but tell us, how did you and Oliver sit down and really distill this elephant in the room of the military-industrial complex?
In a way, I must say that the piece wrote itself because of recent developments. A few things. One, you know, we opened the piece with a quote from Jimmy Carter, which is pretty incredible. Here's a former president of the United States who, in a conversation with Donald Trump, said the U.S. is the most warlike nation that has ever existed. Meditate on that for a little bit. That's an incredible statement. By the way, it's factually true, though to say it, especially for a former president, is quite profound. And then we go from there. And then around the same time, it came out the Pentagon is making preparations for war with China and Russia at the same time. Then Mike Pompeo gave a speech at West Point in which he said that everyone there had to be prepared to fight somewhere around the world, that all of them would have to fight somewhere around the world, including in this hemisphere. We are on a permanent war footing. And it's killing us. I mean, obviously, it's killing other people. It's destroying other nations. But it's killing this society. And we wanted to talk about that, that we're heading into new elections in which people are talking about great things like Medicare for all and Green New Deals and eradicating student debt. But if you don't stop giving over $1 trillion a year to the military, you will not have any of those things. And Oliver and I wanted to say, look, we got to link those issues with fighting the war machine. And so that's how the piece came about.
So Dan Kovalik, that's a great point. And again, we're referencing your article in the Boston Globe, co-written with Oliver Stone, We Must Stop Our Nation's Push for Relentless War. And one of the things I loved about this piece is exactly what you just pointed out, which is in the piece you get into how Tulsi Gabbard is one of the few candidates that is actively campaigning against the military-industrial complex. who is a veteran herself, so of course very credible and can't be labeled as unpatriotic, even though the mainstream media is still trying to do so. But one of the things that I love about this piece is you talk about how things like student loan debt or Medicare for all these ambitious programs, where do you think the money's going to come from? It's going to have to come out of the military-industrial complex, yet so few people are actually willing to talk about that root cause. So why do you think that is?
It's a great question. I think, unfortunately, this country has become, look, parts of it obviously are addicted to war. I mean, certainly, and the economy is a war economy. So that's part of it. But I think also the younger generation growing up, it's not so much they're addicted to war, but they're used to it. It's become such a part of our society, such a part of our culture that people don't even question it. And then so when you have someone like Tulsi Gabbard, before I came on the show, I was listening to NPR. They have a series where they're going in depth in every Democratic candidate. Tonight was Tulsi Gabbard, and it was a hit piece on her. They attacked her in the way that they do. Oh, she's supported by right-wingers like Steve Bannon, right? And they undermine her credibility. And why? They say it because she is opposing regime change and intervention. Because this country has decided that we are the nation that will set the world right, that will defend human rights, that will bring democracy by bombing people. And that assumption and that initial standpoint is just so dangerous. And frankly, liberals are susceptible or more susceptible to that than anyone. So that's where we're at.
That's pretty amazing in terms of, like you said, the permanent war state. It's hard to say that the population per se is, quote, addicted to the warfare, but certainly the military, the national security of industrial complex, it's their life's blood to leech off the public sector, to leech off the treasury. It's not just the military and surveillance industrial complex, of course. We also have to deal with big pharma, big ag, these kinds. There's competing interests here, but it's very clearly an oligarchy with plutocrats in purportedly elected office. And then let's get over to the corporate press, right? And you and Oliver Stone, of course, mention a little bit of this. The corporate press is basically beholden to these factions in the society because of their reliance on support and ad money. Can you talk a little about that conundrum?
The one thing we mentioned is that the elite press tends to outflank Trump on the right, even papers like the New York Times, where they go Trump into attacking other countries. We mentioned the one article that the New York Times had saying that Trump ran on a platform to tame rogue states. Now they're taming him. And they mentioned North Korea and Vietnam and Iran. And they really double dog dare him to go after these countries and suggest he's not being tough enough on them. And that is where the mainstream press is at, where they believe that the U.S. exists to tame these rogue nations. And of course, they ignore the fact that the U.S. is the biggest rogue nation in the world.
The largest arms supplier, the largest single country supporter of the world's dictators, and that's also the United States. These are all other elephants in the room.
And if the human and financial cost of these endless wars wasn't enough, what I really like about your piece is that you also call out the environmental cost, noting that the Pentagon and U.S. military are the biggest world polluters today.
It's very interesting that when you look at statistics on countries producing CO2, what is left out of it is the U.S. military. The U.S. military produces more CO2 than the U.S. nation in terms of its industry. And so if you look at the total output of CO2 by the U.S. plus its military, it's twice as big as we think. And again, that is left out of the calculus. And if people got their heads around that, that if you want to be a true environmentalist, the best thing you could do is challenge the U.S. war machine, because that is creating more CO2 than any other nation.
In fact, Dan Kovalik, that was a top censored story back in 2010, 2011. And even though we would think that more people should know this by now, it's still a widely underreported, undiscussed, and seemingly unknown detail of the cost and consequences of U.S. empire. That's, again, pretty amazing. This is why we're calling attention again to this recent op-ed, because you packed so much into such a small space, including, as you mentioned before, the elite and establishment addiction to war and the necessity for this to drive policy. You had a quote from Vice President Mike Pence that was pretty alarming. Share with our listeners what Pence was saying when he was talking to a graduating class at West Point.
Yes, he said, all of you can be assured that you will be fighting somewhere in the world, including in this hemisphere, meaning the Western Hemisphere. I mean, he assured all those future soldiers that they would be in combat. And Pence revealed something incredible, that we are planning to be at war forever. And that is something we must resist and say no to.
Recently, there was another Stop the War Machine event in Washington, D.C. with Cindy Sheehan, and I had participated in one last year with her and others out here in Northern California. Given your experience, and you have a long history of activism, and of course you also teach at the University of Pittsburgh, what exactly do you think it's going to take to mobilize the population here to really get the core of what you and Oliver Stone wrote about in your op-ed? We already have a spiraling out of control military budget. And again, despite all the reports that seem to suggest the economy's doing well, nearly half of people in the U.S. polled say they can barely live paycheck to paycheck. What is it going to take, do you think, Dan Kovalik, for people to connect some of these dots, other than if we had an actual vibrant and true press talking about these things?
Obviously, you're raising the question that we have to answer. And what we try to point out, look, there is an environmental movement. There are movements to end student debt. There are movements to have universal health care. There's all kinds of movements that are very progressive, but they all need to realize that the main thing holding us back on all those issues is this eternal war footing. And if we could connect those dots and build a real peace movement that focuses on the fact that we are not fulfilling human needs while we spend trillions on war, then we're doomed. But I think that people are starting to see that. I think the candidacy of Tulsi Gabbard is an example of that. She was the most Googled candidate after the Democratic debates. But we just need to keep pushing these ideas and convince people that the road to war is a road to death for all of us, for the world.
So, Dan Kovalik, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. In many ways, what I think we're up against is kind of centuries worth of marketing and branding. And the two in particular, one is the assumption that the U.S. military is out there serving as the only well-intentioned world police, and that that is our rightful job to do so. That, I think, is one branded assumption that many people in the populace have today. And the other is simply that any kind of dissent is unpatriotic and borderline treasonous. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the marketing and branding that has become so normalized here in America, but abroad, as you've also stated in the article, we're seen as and have been polled as the greatest threat to world peace.
First of all, the poll you mentioned interviewed people in 60 different countries, and almost 25% of the people polled said the U.S. was the biggest threat to world peace. No other country came close. I think the next country was like at 8 or 9%. So the U.S. was definitely polled as the greatest threat to world peace. But you would never get that idea from the press or the popular culture as portrayed by Hollywood. So, for example, the Marvel films. My kids love these superhero films. Look at Black Panther, for example. The one white hero in the movie was a CIA agent. That's not accidental. in Captain Marvel, which was seen as this great feminist movie, many have pointed out, including the Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal, the Gray Zone, that it really became an advertisement for the U.S. military. In fact, the movie has openly been used by the U.S. military to try to recruit people. But also, near the end of the movie, and I saw the movie, Captain Marvel lets this child determine what color her uniform will be, and it ends up being red, white, and blue, of course. You see this everywhere. Is it a coincidence that right now, well, the government's trying to build up anti-Russia hysteria, that many years after the fact, you have this mini series about Chernobyl, and I've been watching Stranger Things with my family, the new season, and the Soviet Union is the villain in it. And they keep talking about the Ruskies and the Russians.
That show takes place in the 80s, right? The timing of the reintroduction of it is no accident. The fact that they're going there and reintroducing conveniently as part of the theme of the show, right, that it dovetails with, well, the new Cold War. And that's something that we want to talk about after this break, Dan Kovalik. We need to take a break and remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri, and we are speaking with Dan Kovalik. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His most recent book out on Skyhorse Hot Books is The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. When we come back after the break, we're going to go and talk about a few of his other publications as well, including one that was discussing the reprise of Russia and Russiagate. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. Today on the program, we're joined by Dan Kovalik. He is author of the critically acclaimed The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, also The Plot to Attack Iran, and The Plot to Control the World. His books are out on Hot Books, Skyhorse Press, out of New York. Dan Kovalik, before the break, we were talking about Cold War propaganda, Cold War redux coming up on television and Hollywood movies. It's really just written right into the script. And of course, listeners of this show know we've talked about the CIA's entertainment liaison program, post 9/11 meetings with Don Rumsfeld, Condi Rice at the Beverly Hills Hotel, shows and movies like Zero Dark 30 or things like Homeland. They're really literally written right into the plots of these, this kind of permanent war propaganda that helps the public come to the conclusion which states are the enemy and who's the enemy in this decade. So Dan Kovalik, before that, we were talking a little bit about the redux of the Cold War. And of course, one of your books from Hot Books is The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. So we have a lot to go through here today with so much of your material, and there are so many common threads through them. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about what's going on now with Russia, because the U.S. appears to be angling to demonize Russia for quite some time. In fact, after the decline and removal of Boris Yeltsin, which the Clinton administration even helped him get into office as far as election meddling goes. But Dan Kovalik, talk to us about your work on scapegoating Russia.
We've been seeing this for quite some time. So we have to go back a bit. When Vladimir Putin was first elected president of Russia, he was seen as a Democrat, as a great Democratic leader. And why? Because he came out of the Boris Yeltsin administration, which the U.S., as you noted, backed to the hilt to the point of, in 1996, really engineering his reelection when he was polling at less than 6% popularity. And so Putin at first was kind of the glory boy for the U.S. until he opposed the U.S. invasion in Iraq in 2003. And that's when the U.S. began to rethink its relationship with Russia and with Putin. You might recall that George W. Bush, upon meeting Putin, said that he was a friend and he looked into Putin's eyes and he saw his soul. It was all positive and friendship, again, until he opposed our war in Iraq. Of course, Putin ended up being right. Putin said, look, there aren't weapons of mass destruction. This is going to destabilize the Middle East. He was right. Bush was wrong. But you have to go back to the brothers Karamazov, great quote in there that says you can forgive people when they're wrong. You can't forgive people when they're right. So we never forgave Putin for being right about the Iraq war. But then after that, he was given a bit of a second chance. But then came the war on Libya in 2011. Putin went along with that at first, at least to the point of setting up a no-fly zone. He supported that. But then when it came to the regime change against Gaddafi, which he knew would destabilize Libya, he was like, this is going too far. And he said, I will not allow any more regime changes in this region. And again, that's when Obama really turned against Putin. And the U.S. from that time on would continue to vilify Putin in many different ways, because he would not go along with the U.S. regime change programs. And that's what it comes down to.
And then the major instigation in Ukraine.
That's another thing. I mean, in 2014, Obama supported and helped engineer a coup in the Ukraine, a right-wing coup, which brought into power neo-Nazis, which, again, has been very much downplayed by the U.S. press. And I must, in fact, give kudos to Oliver Stone, who just won a big prize at a film festival in Sicily for his film on the Ukraine, in which he talks about the coup and how the right wing took over in the coup that Obama helped engineer.
And then, of course, Vice President Joe Biden's son mysteriously ends up on the country's largest natural gas board. You can't really make it up, right? It's again, right out of the Cold War files of messing around in other countries' politics, other countries' elections. One would think the U.S. protests too much with this talk of Russia meddling in U.S. elections. I mean, the United States has been meddling in elections for ages. And in fact, you talk about that more in another book that you did not long ago, The Plot to Control the World, how the U.S. spent billions to change the outcome of elections around the world.
And I give many examples of that. And apropos of what you're talking about, I talk about how Clinton really took charge of Yeltsin's campaign in 1996 to win the election there, when, again, he had about 6% approval rating. I talk about the Ukraine, where the U.S. intervened to make sure, again, that these right-wing forces came to power in the Ukraine. It's fascinating. The U.S. believes it has the right to interfere in countries halfway around the world, like the Ukraine, right? Like Iran, like Iraq, like Libya. But Russia has no right to have any influence on its borders, Ukraine being on the border. And I think what we have to look at and question is, why does the U.S. feel it has dominion over the entire world? Why does it feel what can happen in the Persian Gulf? It can decide that. But Persia, Iran cannot. Or China is not allowed influence in the South China Sea. Only the U.S. is. This is a sickness, really. The idea that we can have influence everywhere, no matter how far flung a country might be. But countries like China or Russia can't even have influence on their own borders. It's quite stunning, really.
Indeed, Dan Kovalik. And again, this is the topic of so many of your books and your public talks. Again, like to remind listeners that, Dan Kovalik, you will be in the San Francisco Bay Area where we're based. Of course, the Project Censored Show airs on about 50 stations from Hawaii to New York, as well as online. And you may want to share. Do you have any place online where you can share with our listeners so they can, A, learn more about your fantastic work, and B, maybe some of the places you're speaking?
You can find me on Twitter at Daniel M. Kovalik. You can find me on Facebook at Dan Kovalik. I write a lot for Counterpunch. You can find me at Skyhorse Publishing. Those are probably the best places to find me.
Right. And then when this show airs, we always put links to some of the pieces, articles, the work of the guests, and we will certainly do the same for you, Dan. Dan Kovalik will be speaking in Berkeley Wednesday, August 14th at 7:30 p.m. That's at the Hillside Club in North Berkeley. That's 2286 Cedar Street. So, Dan Kovalik, it'll be great to have you out here, and I want listeners to know that if you're in the Bay Area, definitely come on out and not only support KPFA, but Dan's wonderful work, prolific writer in the last couple of years in particular. Dan, I wanted to get your thoughts on this, and I know this is a can of worms. We were just talking a little bit ago about Russia. That dovetails me into the discussion of Russiagate, so-called Russiagate. And I'm not going to say there's much ado about nothing here. I'm not going to suggest that there aren't many problems in the Trump administration and with the campaign and so forth. It's also known, of course, that Russia was attempting to do some meddling in the election. However, the hay that's been made of this whole fiasco with the Mueller report, what are your thoughts on that topic?
I am willing to say that this is much ado about nothing. If you accepted every allegation against Russia as true in regards to the 2016 election, you would accept the fact that someone in Russia took out thousands of dollars in Facebook and Twitter ads when, of course, Clinton and Trump took out millions of dollars in ads, and that someone in Russia hacked into the DNC computer and John Podesta's computer and exposed to the world the truth that the DNC engineered the 2016 primaries to get Clinton elected over Bernie Sanders. Okay. Let's accept all that is true. And I think there's a lot of evidence that maybe the Russians didn't hack into those computers, but let's assume they did. Okay, first of all, I'm glad to know that the DNC is manipulating their primaries for the establishment candidates against the insurgents, who most of us like. And again, if some Russians took out a very modest amount of Facebook and Twitter ads, that does not upset me that much. You know, the fact is, if we accept every allegation is true, Russia had a minimal impact in the 2016 election.
Of course, there's efforts, but it doesn't amount to much in the big picture. Just look at corporate media. I mean, we're talking about $6 billion of coverage, where they did almost no investigative reporting. They were basically just platforms and stenographers to allow candidates to spew their campaign rhetoric at one another.
What got Trump elected was that CNN and other mainstream outlets decided that he was good for ratings, and they gave him millions of dollars in free publicity, which he counted on. He knew they would do that.
Indeed. Well, Les Moonves bragged about it at CBS.
That's what got him elected. And let's be honest about that. What also got him elected, first of all, that we have an outdated electoral college system, which allowed someone like Donald Trump to be president, even though he got nearly 3 million votes less than Hillary Clinton. Okay, the Russians didn't do that. Our founding fathers did. What else got him elected was the fact that about a million people were wrongly thrown out of voter rolls, as Greg Palast, the great journalist, has pointed out. And if I may quote Jimmy Carter, we do not have a functioning democracy in this country. That is the problem. It's not the Russians. It's what's happening internally, that this country has been hijacked by big money. We do not have one person, one vote. And that is what is preventing us from electing someone who will govern in the interests of the American people.
I'd like to remind listeners that we are speaking with Dan Kovalik. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He's also the author of four books, from Skyhorse and Hot Books. Most recently, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. After this musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dan Kovalik, and we are going to talk more about a couple of his other books, including one on Iran, and then we want to bring it up more to the present as well with Venezuela. Stay with us.
Now you masters of war, you that build all of the guns, you that build the dead planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, just want you to know that I see through your mask.
We are back with guest Dan Kovalik, teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and we're discussing his work, his many books. We've hit a couple of them on Russia, The Plot, The Scapegoat, Russia. We also have talked a little bit about elections issues and the plot to basically control the world, the U.S., through elections. We were speaking about an op-ed that he did with Oliver Stone about the military-industrial complex. We were just talking a little bit about elections and issues that led to the rise of Trump, but I wanted to come a little bit closer to present on your two other books, the most recent on Venezuela, just out. But before that, you did a book called The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. And Noam Chomsky calls this a treasure trove of information that Americans should know, but scarcely do. And of course, Dan Kovalik, many of your books do exactly that. Let's talk a little bit about U.S. empire, U.S. foreign policy, and the ever-resurgent saber-rattling, now also with Iran.
I think Iran is a great place to start for any of these discussions because Iran was the first place that the CIA began its regime change program in 1951, really. But it culminated in the overthrow of a democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953. And the tactics the CIA used in Iran then are the same ones they're using today in places like Venezuela. First of all, they undermine the economy. That's what we did to Iran during that time. We actually made it impossible for Iran to sell it's oil, and that's what we're trying to do now under Trump. The other thing the CIA did, it would pay people to riot and engage in violent protest. And again, that's exactly what the U.S. does in places like Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Iran also today. And so we see this very troubling pattern where the U.S. overthrows democratically elected governments, because in this case in Iran, Mossadegh decided to nationalize Iranian oil, which had been up to that point controlled by the British, and it installed a king, the Shah of Iran, who ruled with an iron fist until he was overthrown in 1979. And we've never forgiven the Iranians for that revolution, for overthrowing what Amnesty International said was the most brutal regime in the world at the time of the revolution. And so we learned many lessons from that regime change operation, but there are lessons that many Americans know nothing about.
So Dan, let me ask you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one thing that I see that Venezuela and Iran have in common is that they appear to be the two countries with the greatest amount of oil reserves besides the U.S. How much do you think that factors into some of the rhetoric that we're seeing and some of the saber rattling that Mickey had mentioned earlier?
I think it has everything to do with it. You know, again, going back to Noam Chomsky, as he said with the Iraq War, if Iraq's biggest export were cabbage, we would not have intervened there, right? Oil rules the world. And by the way, again, as Chomsky notes, it's not so much that we're doing these things for access to oil. We don't need oil. The U.S. is now a net exporter of fossil fuels because of our oil reserves and fracking, but it wants to control oil because still the world needs it, and the U.S. wants to make sure that U.S. companies profit from it. And so when a country like Venezuela, which now we know has the largest oil reserves on earth, when they decide to nationalize their oil and to use it for their people's benefit instead of for the benefit of countries like Exxon, the U.S. takes great umbrage in that. And it has been trying for many years, not just recently, but really the last 20 years, to take back the control of Venezuela's oil so that U.S. companies can profit from it.
So, Dan, let me follow up with that. Would it be silly or naive for our listeners to hope that the proliferation of electric vehicles worldwide might actually in some way be the most direct way to combat the military-industrial complex because there will be less desire to go out and control the world's oil reserves?
Well, I think that's a start, certainly. But of course, we also have to look at the fact that in the end, when you charge an electric car, you still have to charge it with right. energy from the electric grid, which many times is itself fueled by oil. So I'm not sure that's a cure-all, but we certainly have to move in the direction towards electric cars, towards solar energy, wind energy. And yes, if we start to depend on renewables over oil, I do think that will undermine the military-industrial complex.
I guess what I'm saying then, Dan, is at that point, wouldn't the military-industrial complex simply move on to the next most valuable natural resource available?
Certainly they might. I mean, the military-industrial complex has its own logic, and its logic, of course, is permanent war for its own sake. Because as long as we have war, companies that profit in war benefit, right? Those companies that make weapons for war, that do services for soldiers, that make uniforms for soldiers, will always benefit if we're at war, regardless what that war is about. And that is the logic of the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned us against. And that complex that Eisenhower saw is nothing compared to what we have today.
Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address, 1961. Earlier, since you mentioned Eisenhower, some other things that Eisenhower said, the World War II general who became Republican president during the 1950s, vice president was Richard Nixon. Of course, during the 1950s, as we mentioned, that's when we saw the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. We saw the coup in Guatemala. That's on Eisenhower's watch. But it's also fascinating to note that when Stalin died, Eisenhower had a brief bout of thinking that somehow that would be an opportunity to maybe change direction for the Cold War. That's at least one historiographic interpretation. And what I'm pointing out here, I think, ties into what we were discussing earlier, particularly you mentioned things that movements we already have afoot, right? We had Occupy Wall Street that morphed into things like debt relief, right? And of course, to help reduce or to eliminate student debt. You mentioned the Green New Deal. Chase and you a moment ago were talking about the significance of renewables and different kinds of technology. This is a really fascinating quote, I think, from Eisenhower and very telling. And I think it's every bit as much relevant today. Every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. Now, again, this is in the 50s. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. Eisenhower went on to say, "We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This, I repeat, is the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron." And Dan Kovalik, I know you're familiar with that quote.
Yes. And again, it's more relevant today than it was when it was spoken. Right now, I'm being interviewed from a radio station in the Bay Area. When I was in the Bay, maybe 10 years ago, I really thought, my Lord, this is the most beautiful city I've ever seen. But I have to be honest, when I returned a year ago, I was like, oh my God, what has happened to this beautiful city that has tent cities ringing it? We have homeless people in some of the greatest cities on earth in this country. What is happening here? People cannot afford to live in San Francisco or Seattle or New York or LA. And why? Because all the money is going out the door to fight these wars. And that's what Eisenhower was talking about. And we're living that right now.
We're speaking with Dan Kovalik. He is author of 4 books in the last 2 years, all hot books, Sky Horse books, that's out of New York. Those interested in learning more, Dan's last name is spelled K-O-V-A-L-I-K. And of course, once we post this program, we'll have plenty of links for our listeners to follow. Of course, his most recent book that we want to talk a little bit more about when we come back from the break, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Again, our guest is Dan Kovalik. I'm Mickey Huff, your host, along with Chase Palmieri. Project Censored Show will return after this final musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the final segment of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with Dan Kovalik. He teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His most recent book is The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. That came out in June of this year. And again, for those of you who maybe are tuning in late to the show, Dan Kovalik is also a labor and human rights attorney, teaches in the law school at the University of Pittsburgh. And again, Skyhorse Publishing in New York has published his 4 most recent books. And they also involve The Plot to Attack Iran, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, and The Plot to Control the World. Dan Kovalik, in this last segment, I wanted to get into a little bit more detail about your newest work. And I know you're touring the country. And as we mentioned earlier on the show, you will be speaking in the Bay Area August 14th, 7:30 p.m. at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley. You can learn more about that at kpfa.org. But in your book, Plotting Against Venezuela, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, not long ago here, we celebrated, if that's the right word, it was the, quote, Independence Day here in the United States, but it's also Independence Day in Venezuela. And the so-called opposition leader that the U.S. has been trying to install in a slow-motion coup d'etat, Juan Guaido, we've had Abby Martin on the show, we've had a couple other folks on the show talking a lot about what's happening in Venezuela, but we saw that Guaido was calling for a separate independence celebration. He was calling for mass dissidents against the Maduro government. Your book coming out on Venezuela right now is extremely timely. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are your thoughts on the timing of your book release and what's going on right now?
I began the book in February of this year because that's when things were beginning to intensify with the U.S. effort to overthrow Maduro and install Juan Guaido. At the time Juan Guaido declared himself as president, 80% of Venezuelans polled said they didn't even know who Juan Guaido was. He was handpicked by the U.S. to be the leader in Venezuela to represent U.S. interests there. Guaido early on avowed if he became president, he would privatize Venezuelan oil, open it up for private investment, especially from the United States. He said he would end the social programs in Venezuela, which have benefited the poor. For many years, the IMF and World Bank lauded Venezuela for fighting poverty and extreme poverty. Recently, the UN, and when I say recently, in the last month or so, the UN actually declared that Venezuela was one of the few countries on earth that was guaranteeing the right to housing, because it's built about 2.5 million housing units for people in Venezuela. If you assume a family of four in each unit, that's 10 million people housed in Venezuela out of a population of 30 million. Can you imagine if we were doing that in this country? Again, in places like the Bay Area, which could desperately use housing for the poor. But Guaido said he's going to end all those programs, and he's going to privatize oil so that oil will no longer be used to meet human needs in Venezuela, but to profit U.S. companies. And people will say, but I hear there's economic problems now for people in Venezuela. And what's being ignored by the mainstream press is that U.S. sanctions, which have been imposed since 2015, are what are most responsible for the economic woes in Venezuela. A very mainstream economist, Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University, just co-authored a report in which he concluded that 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions imposed by Trump in August 2017. And he predicts that more than 40,000 Venezuelans will die this year due to U.S. sanctions. And so again, like we did to Iran in the 50s, we are now destroying the economy of Venezuela. We are starving the population of Venezuela and then blaming Venezuelan people for starving. That's exactly what the U.S. has been doing to effectuate regime change since the 50s in Iran, since the early 70s in Chile, and now today in Venezuela. We can look at many, many instances of that, but that's what's happening right now.
It seems to be one of the go-to moves in the U.S. military playbook is to put on these economic sanctions, which you could argue is some form of an economic warfare against the well-being of the citizens in that country. And then when things get so desperate and broken down, you start to pitch your regime change candidate and start to rumble the drums of war. So I think that's really interesting. In the closing of your Boston Globe article, you write, "We must demand that our government stop putting resources into war and destruction and instead put those resources toward building, meeting human needs, and saving our environment." You end with a call to action to rebuild the U.S. peace movement as it was during the Vietnam War. And I'm wondering if you see that kind of resistance or that remobilization for a peace movement happening, or if it's just not there.
It hasn't been there for some time. It hasn't been there since the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2002 and 2003, when you saw record numbers of people on the streets opposing war. But I do believe you do see the building, or at least the embryonic stage of a new peace movement. I do think, again, when you look at the interest in people like Tulsi Gabbard, you see people very desperate to end these wars. I think that sentiment is out there. I think it's key that people tap into that sentiment and rebuild the peace movement. I think it's possible, and I think we may be on the brink of it right now.
So Dan Kovalyuk, what about, this is something that's come up certainly in anti-war circles and peace movement circles. In fact, some Democrats in office a number of years ago were criticized for cynically trying to bring back the draft. And of course, one of the reasons for that was to, if there was a draft, that somehow people who are not directly connected to the military, people who are not volunteers to the military, suddenly there would be this generational concern about what exactly U.S. foreign policy looked like because, well, it might actually interfere with the plans you had for your life.
It's a very interesting question. You know, Michael Moore in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11, he was interviewing people in Congress, pointed out that there was only one member of the House of Representatives, only one member had a child that was in the military. we do live in a society in which only the poor are susceptible to having to go to war because they have to go to war for economic reasons. In fact, the one letter I saw in response to our op-ed in the Boston Globe was by a former U.S. Marine who was in the Vietnam War in the 1970s, who said, "We will not have a real peace movement until everyone in this country has skin in the game, until everyone potentially would have to fight." And I think he has a point. I mean, certainly has a point. The reason the draft was gotten rid of is because when everyone in this country was susceptible to being drafted, of course, still the rich had outs, you know, but when it was more or less equal, you had big movements. And I do think that the draft should be at least considered as a means of calling the question, do you really want to go to war? Do you really want to send your kid to war? And right now, the only people who are doing that are people who are doing it by economic necessity. And that is not fair, and it's not right. And it is what allows the war machine to continue without much resistance.
Dan, one of the things I really love about your Boston Globe op-ed is that it takes the anti-war, pro-peace, anti-military industrial complex argument and frames it in an economic way as opposed to simply a moral conversation. And I actually think that this is where a lot of the Democrats and left-leaning people that are anti-war get it wrong, is that you should be positioning this as a cost-benefit analysis. It is costing lives and the environment and untold amounts of money to do these endless wars, whereas it's really an economic trade-off. Where else could that money be going? Do you believe that this is the winning argument here for the pro-peace movement, that you do have to frame it somewhat in an economic sense or in a business mindset?
I think in many ways it is. Again, if you look at popular candidates like Bernie Sanders, who could really win the nomination, who could really win the presidency, he's running on a populist economic platform in which he has called for the eradication of student debt. He's calling for Medicare for all. He is calling for our money, our tax dollars, to be spent for human needs. But the flip side of that is that if you're going to do that, you got to take it away from the military budget. That's the piece that's not being discussed. But I think that's the piece that is critical and that people will get on board with, because they do want money spent for human needs. I think Sanders has shown that there is a desire for that. There's a hunger for that. And we need to say, hey, look, if you want that, you can't keep spending trillions on war.
So, Dan Kovalik, we have a few minutes left in this segment. Again, we want to thank you for coming on the show today. But speaking of other elephants in the room, the military-industrial complex, that's, of course, a big part of your books and the op-ed with Oliver Stone that we've been discussing. But also, you've also been a labor attorney, and you worked with United Steelworkers, correct?
Yes, over 25 years.
You've recently stepped down from that role. Is that true?
I retired earlier this year.
I'm from back in that neck of the woods. I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and came from a working class family. So the other elephant in the room here that I wanted to end on is the role of labor and the working class and the politicization of the working class. Over 100 years ago, there was much more political literacy, even, I would suggest, and argue, and even more diverse newspapers and outlets. A lot of working unions and so forth published their own news and information for themselves. What is your thought on that? And what do you think the role of labor is really going to have to play here?
I think unions, in my view, have to go back to having a feeling of true internationalism, which I think was lost some time ago in the Cold War. They have to see their fate connected to the fates of workers everywhere. And when workers, for example, in third world countries, places like Bangladesh, when they're getting paid pennies an hour to do work we're doing here, all of us will suffer, right? Because capital will flow to those countries. But the answer to that is to make sure that everyone in the world gets a living wage. And I think unions and labor can be a part of that conversation and a part of a movement to do that. There have been efforts in that regard, anti-sweatshop movements that are very laudable. But I think that needs to be the focus of labor, not focuses on tariffs and protectionism. We have to raise all the boats in the world and not just our own. And I think labor forgot that some time ago and needs to remember it now.
Well, given the global capitalist institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, I mean, they've even admitted that neoliberal austerity has been a failure. Trickle down was a lie from the beginning. This is certainly things that workers have felt and known for decades. In your experience, both in terms of human rights and your experience in labor, do you think we're on the cusp of some turning tides here?
We're starting to see that. I mean, one very hopeful sign was the workers at Wayfair company who went on strike to oppose Wayfair selling beds to these horrible detention centers on the border. We're certainly seeing some labor awakening, particularly in the universities, the movements around adjuncts, for example. What's happened to the universities? You know, they've been Walmartized. What's happened in the greater economy has happened everywhere in our society, including in the universities. And I think people are seeing that. They're resisting. And that is where change will happen.
Well, Dan Kovalik, again, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. As Oliver Stone has said about your work, thankfully, Kovalik helps to cut through the Orwellian lies and dissembling, which make this intervention possible. The intervention, of course, we're talking about foreign policy with Venezuela, Iran, etc. And Stone continues, just when such truth-telling is so desperately needed. Speaking of that, Dan Kovalik, your newest book is just out from Hot Books, Skyhorse Publishing in New York. It's called The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela: How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Dan Kovalik, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fess is our senior producer and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer. The Project Censored Show airs on over 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to The Project Censored Show on YouTube and your cell phone's podcast app. Feel free to share your feedback about our work, and last but not least, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in our